And now I'm delighted to introduce not one, but two fantastic speakers today. We are joined by Dr. Alan Rankin. He's a practicing hospitalist clinician educator at Providence Portland Medical Center. He did his medical school at University of Tennessee College of Medicine and then residency at OHSU. Dr. Rankin has previously earned both the Providence Portland Resident Teacher of the Year and Providence Portland Hospitalist of the Year. And he's currently involved in multiple QI programs, including the Oregon Region Heart Failure Focus Group and the Chemical Dependency Resource Group. We're also joined by Dr. Ben Pedroja, who is also a practicing hospitalist clinician educator at Providence Portland. He earned his medical degree at SUNY Upstate Medical University and then did residency at Providence Portland. He's involved in several leadership, quality improvement, and teaching roles, among them the Interprofessional Unit Collaborative Physician Lead and a member of the Code Blue and Code Stroke committees. He's also director of the Internal Medicine Residency Point of Care Ultrasound and Simulation Curricula. We're so delighted to have this dynamic duo here today to teach us a lot about hospital medicine. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here. And thank you, those at home listening in online. Okay, so title of our talk today is Selected Updates in Hospital Medicine 2024, the Year in Review. I'll speak for about 25 minutes, and then I'll hand things over to my colleague, Dr. Alan Rankin. A few objectives here to review with you guys, maybe. Still working. Oh, sorry, guys. Used to be unfrozen. Just like click. Okay, click. Objectives. Hoping to review, interpret, and incorporate recent literature relevant to the practice of hospital medicine, really trying to focus on those studies that are informing our practice or perhaps changing our practice. And we're going to take a case-based approach here and try to keep things moving as well. We've got quite a bit to cover. All right. So our first case here is a 76-year-old female, history of diabetes and CKD, chronic anemia, presenting with chest pain. So you see your vital signs there, generally unremarkable cardiopulmonary exam. Noticing though that troponin up to 1100, you're seeing some lateral T-wave changes and some ST segment depressions on EKG. We have a new wall motion abnormality noted on echo, and then that hemoglobin at 9.2, which is about her baseline. All right, question for us. Which of the following is the most appropriate transfusion threshold for this patient presenting with an MI? This is perhaps 7 to 8 grams per deciliter, maybe it's 10 or 12 grams per deciliter, or perhaps we ought to avoid transfusion due to the risk of volume overload. So I'll let you think about that for a moment. Okay, so the background here, really 7 grams or 7 to 8 grams has really been the standard for most patients admitted to the hospital. This was based on earlier data, many of whom would have declined to accept a patient like this into their study with an MI. And so there's been an ongoing controversy that perhaps we ought to have a slightly higher transfusion threshold for these folks. The idea being that if you can improve the carrying capacity in the throes of a coronary event, that perhaps you can improve outcomes that way. But really, this hasn't been borne out by the literature. There's been several small randomized controlled trials, many of whom had conflicting results. And so we don't really have good guidance in this area. And actually, we had a reality trial. This was in 2021, 668 patients admitted to VA ICUs, randomized to a restrictive transfusion protocol. And they actually had a slightly higher rate of adverse events here with the liberal group plotted in yellow. And so this seemed to lend further support to this idea that we ought to be sticking with this more restrictive protocol as we do more broadly in the hospital. But we actually have some new evidence in this area that I want to share with you. We had the MINT trial published last year. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine, titled Restrictive or Liberal Transfusion Strategy in MI and Anemia. So this was an open label randomized controlled trial. This was 3,500 patients, by far the largest study in this area, admitted to 44 sites in 6 countries, including the US. And the admission criterion was an acute MI with a hemoglobin of 10 or less. Notably, 55%, over 50% of the folks had type 2 events, and you couldn't have a STEMI to make it into this trial. So the interventions here was to randomize to a restrictive strategy, transfusing at 7 to 8 grams per deciliter versus a more liberal strategy at 10 grams per deciliter. And what they did here was they would basically transfuse you immediately upon randomization and then continuing to transfuse throughout the hospital course to maintain your hemoglobin above 10. And the primary outcome they were looking at was a composite outcome of MI or death within 30 days. So here's a plot of the average hemoglobin concentration over time up to 3 days, where the yellow group or the yellow line here is the liberal strategy. You can see their hemoglobin jumps up to 10 and then stays there. And they delivered a lot of product for this study, triple the number of transfusions versus the more restrictive protocol. And looking at their outcomes, they did see a slight trend towards benefit with the liberal transfusion strategy. So plotted here is the cumulative incidence of the primary outcome, again, which was recurrent MI or death up to 30 days. The yellow is here the liberal strategy. You can see slightly lower point estimate of these outcomes, down to 14.7% from 16.9%. Did not achieve statistical significance, though just barely. Importantly, though, there was no signal for harm. There's always concern for overload in this population, which was pretty well equivalent between the groups. Now, the real story with this trial was down into the subgroup. So this is a subgroup listed here on the left. This is their tree, where to the left of the line favors the restrictive strategy, to the right favors the more liberal strategy. And to call your attention to this group, these are folks with type 1 MIs, where the relative risk reduction in this group was 24%, with a number needed to treat of 23. If you compare that to folks with type 2 MIs, where there was really no benefit seen at all. So, in bottom line here is that the liberal transfusion strategy did seem to yield slightly lower point estimates of recurrent MI and death at 30 days. This was not significant, however. And virtually all of this benefit was seen among patients with type 1 MIs. Now, no signal for harm either. Now, the limitations, this was open label. It's hard to conceal your patient getting triple the number of transfusions over a hospitalization. And we're talking about a very small effect size. But I think the most important caveat with the interpretation of this study really has to do with the power of this study to actually detect a difference within this subgroup, right? And in my mind, that's key to the interpretation here. Are we willing to change practice based on a subgroup analysis of type 1 events? And in my mind, I think it's compelling. We saw 3,500 patients, we had a good mix of folks, more than half of whom had type 2 events. And so really, in my mind, I think we ought to be considering a change here, putting our threshold up to 10 grams per deciliter in folks with a type 1 MI. Okay, moving on. Case number 2. We have a 79-year-old man with diabetes, CAD, presenting with shortness of breath and cough. He noticed a fever, tachycardia, tachypnea, barely hanging on to his blood pressure and sat at 80% on room air. He looks ill and he's got some increased work of breathing, diminished breath sounds on the left. Otherwise, we're seeing a normal exam. Workup's notable for a high white count, elevated leukocytosis and procalcitonin. You're noticing a left lower opacity on chest x-ray. COVID and flu are negative. So hospital course, diagnosed with community acquired pneumonia, which we can call CAP here. They're stabilized with antibiotics and fluids in the emergency department and then triaged to the floor on 6 liters of oxygen. Now, perhaps unexpectedly, now seeing worsening hypoxia, oxygen requirements now jumping up to 20 liters, requiring high flow nasal cannula to maintain saturations, and the hospitalist is now paged to the bedside. Okay, so question for us, which of the following steroid strategies will best optimize this patient's outcome? Is that A, avoid steroids as they're contraindicated in pneumonia. Reserve steroids for patients with CAP and refractory shock. This is largely what the guidelines would tell us we ought to do. Or we have reserve steroids for patients with CAP requiring mechanical ventilation, or perhaps we ought to consider steroids now. Again, we have a severely ill patient with community-acquired pneumonia. Okay, background for steroids and pneumonia. You, I'm sure, are all aware this has been debated for years and years, and there's really been a lot of work in this area over time. And in fact, we had a 2017 Cochrane review, which did seem to show a decreased mortality, decreased need for intubation, mechanical ventilation, and lower lengths of stay in folks who were treated with steroids with severe CAP. And this was including 17 trials with over 2,000 patients. The trouble here is the quality of the evidence was considered to be moderate at best. And this treatment was really not recommended in guidelines either by the thoracic societies or the Infectious Disease Society of America. So it really has not come into the standard care for patients with severe pneumonia. And in fact, we had a study in 2022 One of the two recent big studies in this area, the ESCAPE study, which showed among 586 patients that there really was not a mortality benefit here. And these were critically ill patients admitted to 41 VA ICUs, randomized to get methylpred versus placebo and followed for 60 days. Now, the new trial I want to tell you about is the Cape Cod trial, which was published in May 2023 in the New England Journal of Medicine. You can see the title there, hydrocortisone and severe community-acquired pneumonia. And this trial is really asking us to revisit this question of steroids and pneumonia. So this was a multi-center double-blind RCT. The population was 800 critically ill patients admitted to 31 centers in France, all between 2015 and 2020. This was a sick population. Almost a quarter were intubated. Another 40% were on high-flow nasal cannula. Notably, you could not have septic shock, flu, or unwilling to be intubated to be into the study. And notably, this was halted after a planned interim analysis in 2020 in March. You may recall it would have been a difficult time to continue a study like this. Okay. And now the interventions here, they actually randomized folks to receive IV hydrocortisone given as a continuous infusions, 200 milligrams per day versus placebo. And at day four, they would make a decision as to whether to complete 8 or 14 days of steroids based on physician judgment of clinical response. Outcomes here, all-cause mortality at 28 days, then a couple secondary outcomes, which is all-cause mortality at 90 days, ICU length of stay, and then progression towards need of mechanical ventilation. They had a couple safety outcomes that were listed there as well. So plotted here is the risk of death here, the placebo in green, the hydrocortisone in this yellow orange color, and you can see risk reduction at 5.6%, which put the number needed to treat at 17.5, and this effect was durable down to 8 to 90 days. And importantly, there was a lower risk of intubation. So if you look at the subgroup of patients who were not intubated at the start of the trial, that's 442 patients, the hazard ratio was way down to 0.59 for receiving mechanical ventilation during the study period. And there was no difference in bleeding, other adverse outcomes, aside from a slightly higher average rate of insulin, which you may expect in a patient like this. So bottom line here, I think we're seeing accumulating evidence that steroids are beneficial for severely ill patients with CAP. And based on the decreased need of intubation in this trial, I think it's very reasonable to at least consider steroids in severely ill patients with pneumonia requiring lots of oxygen, like our patient in the question stem, who is on 20 liters of high-flow nasal cannula. I think this is perhaps a surrogate outcome, but I think it's reasonable to expect we may extract some real benefit if we're able to prevent intubations. Now, some caveats. This was stopped early, right? They were aiming to recruit about double the number of these patients, and they also excluded non-severe community-acquired pneumonia. And their mortality overall was about half of what they expected. About 20 to 25% was what was expected. And for some reason, they seem to have recruited a slightly less sick patient population. Not quite sure how that plays, but important to note that. So returning to our question stem, I think it's very reasonable in this severely ill patient with community-acquired pneumonia to at least consider steroids, both for all-cause mortality benefits and the reduced need for intubation that was seen in this study. Okay, moving right along. We have a case number three. This is a 48-year-old male with hypertension, alcohol use disorder, presenting with one day of epigastric pain, nausea, and vomiting. You can see the vital signs there, slightly tachycardic, otherwise doing okay. He has some epigastric tenderness on exam. Workup notable for a very high lipase. You can see an LFT changes in a pattern consistent with alcohol use. We had a blood alcohol level of 45 and some pancreatic stranding seen on CT. So, question for us, which of the following fluid resuscitation strategies would you choose to prevent disease progression? So, is this A, normal saline at 250 mils an hour? Is this B, lactated ringers at 250 hours plus a bolus? Or maybe we ought to do slightly lower rates without the bolus, only as needed. And just for your recollection from last year, we had the waterfall trial, which would really point us towards a more moderate resuscitation strategy, right? So it's really just between normal saline and lactated ringers as the best action choices. Okay, now in the interest of time, I'm actually going to skip ahead to the punchline. I'm sorry to do this to you guys. We had the Apprentice study, which I want to tell you about. And this was a large cohort study where they had 1,000 patients. It's kind of looking at different treatment groups, whether you received LR in the first 24 hours, whether you received NS in the first 24 hours, or if you received both, and looking at the rate of progression to severe pancreatitis. And we saw a pretty massive reduction, 48% reduction in patients who received LR during that first hospital day. And this seemed to be consistent across subgroups. They looked at the etiology of the pancreatitis, didn't seem to be a difference, pretty robust effect there. And they also did some exclusions based on the waterfall criterion. They excluded those patients who received what would be considered an aggressive resuscitation strategy, and still they saw this benefit. So it does seem to be a durable effect here with acute pancreatitis. Now, limitations, of course, this is observational, right? It's a good sized trial, 1,000, but it's observational. And importantly, we don't know what the physicians were using in terms of their treatment goals, right? The waterfall trial and others have shown us that we really ought to be targeting particular clinical indicators as to drive our fluid strategies, whether that's hypotension or other signs of hypovolemia. And we have no idea, no clue really, as to what factors may have been used in this study to guide our treatments. But nonetheless, there was seemed to be a durable association with LR in that first 24 hours in terms of the progression of severe to severe disease. All right, so return to our question, STEM. I think for very clear reasons, consistent with a lot of what we probably already believed, this patient with acute pancreatitis would probably do well with LR. All right, continuing with this same case, we have the same patient here, the 48-year-old with alcohol use disorder and acute pancreatitis, noticing that tachycardia seemed to be improved with LR and the ED there, pain controlled with some IV Dilaudid, and we're seeing some blood pressure stabilizing. Now, the hospitalist is paged now due to agitation and diaphoresis, still boarding in the ED as usual, and we're asked to kind of come in and see what might be going on here. So I think it's no surprise here. This is consideration, at least for alcohol withdrawal. And so you get a little more alcohol use history. Noting that he drinks a fifth of day of alcohol more in recent days. He does have a history of severe withdrawal requiring ICU admission. He does report efforts to cut down and desire to achieve remission. So question for us, which of the following is the most appropriate agent to control withdrawal? Is this A, chlordiazepam oxide, B, diazepam, C, lorazepam, D, phenobarbital, or E? Perhaps all of the above would be appropriate. Okay, so phenobarbital for alcohol withdrawal. So I really do think we're seeing a practice change underfoot, but not because there's new amazing data that I'm here to show you, right? But I want to talk about the state of affairs here with phenobarbital and talk about how we ought to be using this information. Because I, for one, I really think this is a good option for hospitalized patients. I'd like to share you some of these details here. So as you probably know, symptom-triggered benzodiazepines have been first line for a generation or more. And this is really based on pretty limited data. There's been this perceived higher risk of profile with phenobarbital. And a lot of this came, again, from early trials, observational trials. And then we had a statement, a 1996 statement from the American Society of Addiction Medicine saying that because of the synergistic activity of phenobarbital and alcohol, that there was seen to be higher risk, or perceived at least higher risk for sedation, higher risk for respiratory compromise when used phenobarbital. And so for that reason, we've been using benzodiazepines as first line for decades, really. But we're seeing observational studies, lots of them, that seem to show a benefit with phenobarbital over benzos. And some of them here are listed here: reduce ICU admission, reduce length of stay, reduce need for mechanical ventilation, and decrease benzodiazepine requirements overall. So what are the actual evidence we have? The best is probably this 2013 randomized control trial, small study, 102 patients. These were ED folks randomized to either receive symptom-triggered lorazepam plus a loading dose of phenobarbital or symptom-triggered lorazepam alone. And they saw some pretty good benefits here. Reduced ICU admission down to 8% from 25% for folks receiving benzos. The need for lorazepam infusion was reduced, again, down to 4% from 31% with benzos. The total lorazepam needs were reduced, although they did not see any changes in length of stay or any changes in the rate of adverse events. And there was an earlier trial in 2011, even smaller than this one, that had pretty similar findings. And if you took a systematic review, which was published in 2023, had those two trials plus an additional five cohorts, there didn't seem to be any changes in ICU admission. Again, this is five studies seven studies, mostly cohort studies, did not see a benefit there. But importantly, if you pulled up all the adverse outcomes, these were things like respiratory depression, hypotension, seizure, all of the pooled adverse effects did not seem to be different between the groups, right? Here's their forest plot. where to the left would benefit phenobarb, to the right would benefit placebo, and there's just no change seen there. And in 2022, we actually had, a plea for new research published in the Annals, right? Inpatient notes, managing alcohol withdrawal syndrome in the hospital center, study, a call for research, because it's really kind of desperate for new guidance in this area. And I just want to touch on the pharmacology. This is really the story with phenobarbital. This is the reason it's coming to our attention now, is it just has favorable pharmacology for folks in the hospital, has a very long half-life. We're talking days and days. And then you get an auto taper over days as well, which provides continued benefit even after the hospitalization. And you can see you can get very high therapeutic levels. This is graphing CSF level over time, with a red line there is a theoretical therapeutic level. You can give a big loading dose all at once, get above that level, then it'll stay there. And if you give additional doses beyond this, it'll just step up to a higher level and it'll stay at that higher level, again, for days and days. It has a very predictable and linear dose relationship. If you give 10 megs per kg, you can be pretty confident you're gonna get between 10 and 15 milligrams per kilogram in the serum, and has a great predictable dose response curve, right, with a very wide therapeutic window. So I'm plotting sedative effect over dose here. The purple line is phenobarb, where those sedative effects don't really take hold until you're up to about 50 milligrams per kilogram. Typical doses, again, for alcohol use disorder are down here, 10 to 20. Contrast with benzodiazepines, where you get nearly immediate sedative effect, even with those early doses, and you never really know how steep this curve is gonna be. And if you put a same graph here of CSF level over time for phenobarbitals, for lorazepam, you see a very complicated course here. Those initial doses need to be stacked to get to your therapeutic level. And then because of that short half-life, you get this seesawing effect. So you're closely monitoring, requiring frequent redosing, sometimes even in the ICU. And I think we've all seen those variable dose responses, patient to patient, and those paradoxical reactions where you're triggering agitation and delirium in these patients. So for all these reasons, I think the bottom line here is that phenobarbital appears to be at least safe and effective alternative to benzodiazepines for alcohol withdrawal. And pharmacology really is what has this drawn to our attention. Now, some limitations. Prospective evidence is utterly lacking in this group, right? And there's also no agreed upon dosing protocol. And it's certainly true for our hospital, there seems to be less experience both among doctors and nurses, and is often used improperly. And so that's something to be keeping in mind as this is seen. And I think you guys have probably seen, we have this new pilot that has been rolled out and likely to be rolled out more broadly. So I think you guys are gonna be seeing more phenobarbital for this reason and others. So returning to our question, STEM, I think we are at least adding phenobarbital as the options for treating alcohol withdrawal in the hospital. Okay, last topic. So returning to our same case here, we got the 48-year-old. We've now stabilized things with LR, tolerating a normal diet. CWAS scores are low after receiving a loading dose of phenobarb in the LED, and we're estimating discharge in 24 to 48 hours. Question for us. Which of the following is the best strategy to achieve sustained remission? Is that a chlordiazepoxide taper? Are we considering naltrexone or acamprosate and refer to outpatient therapy? Maybe consider disulfiram and refer to outpatient therapy, or maybe just outpatient therapy alone. Okay, just quickly here. I love this graph, right? We have this picture. We have the sink overflowing. We got a couple hospitalists here cleaning up the mess. I often feel like this, where I wish you could just turn around and turn off that spigot. But unfortunately, so often we're stuck with our mops and brooms, right? So the background, you guys know this, 140,000 deaths annually from alcohol-related disease. This is more than the opioid epidemic. And we've seen these kind of numbers year after year, as far back as we can calculate them. And for some reason, it seems to get less attention now, but this isn't an epidemic, this is a scourge, right? This has been going on and will continue to go on. And we have medicines for this, right? We know that medication-assisted treatment for alcohol use disorder reduces the risk of return to heavy drinking. And we don't have the same huge trials that we have for methadone and Suboxone, for example. But I think as a surrogate outcome, return to heavy drinking is a reasonable target for us. And these are the list of medicines that are often considered as we think about medication-assisted treatment for alcohol use disorder. And I'll limit our discussion really to these two. Disulfiram has largely fallen out of favor. Just a quick review of the evidence here. This is a systematic review published last year. This is their forest plot, where to the left of the line favors acamprosate, to the right favors placebo. And you can see a risk reduction down to 0.88 with a number needed to treat of 12, right? I don't know about you guys, but I can get to 12 patients pretty fast, right? And the same kind of numbers you're gonna see for naltrexone, with the number needed to treat of 18 with a similar looking tree in this study. You might be asking yourself, well, how do I choose them, right? In my mind, the evidence is about equivalent. It mostly has to do with patient factors as you're making this judgment. I'll just point out a couple things, right? Liver failure and opioid use would be contraindicated in naltrexone. Naltrexone works by blocking those opioid receptors, so you really wouldn't want to be using them. The upside is that it's daily dosing and it's safe with renal disease, of course, which is a problem with renal failure. And downsides are it does block those opiates and it does have a slightly higher rate of headaches. It can't be safe, can't be used in renal failure, although it is safe with renal disease and doesn't have any impact on opioid use. The real downside is the TID dosing. This can be a real challenge for folks. And so you have to have that conversation as you're making this treatment decision. You also have to have this conversation, right? Most of the folks I meet with this kind of issue, GI upset is would be an unwelcome development. And so again, some cost benefit has to be considered here. Now, the work I want to tell you about is this letter that was published in Annals last year. And here's an accompanying editorial. The title is Treatment of Alcohol Use Disorder in Hospitalized Patients, Some Sobering Findings. And so this was an observational cohort study. They basically looked at 28,000 Medicare beneficiaries hospitalized in 2016 with a diagnosis of alcohol use disorder. And they asked the question, what was the rate of MAT for this patient's population up to 30 days after discharge? And this is their data slide. Looking over on the left here, this is any MAT. The white bars are up to 30 days after discharge. And for those of you who can't see the y-axis, that's 2% at the top of that graph, right? 2%. So bottom line here, we are seeing a glaring care gap, right? Barely over 1% of patients filled a prescription for any MAT within 30 days, right? Now, I would just call to your attention that hospitalization is an opportunity for behavioral change. And so we are seeing the vast majority of folks coming through our clutches without attacking this major, major issue. Now, we have some caveats, right? Questionable generalizability in terms of a Medicare population. You looked at the subgroups in this page, this study, seem to have higher prescription rates among younger people, right? Slightly underaccounted in this population, but nonetheless, I think this is reasonably good data to base on. We ought to have some running room with medication-assisted treatment for alcohol use disorder. Now, for any of you residents out there, I would point out this study. This was a QI initiative done by UCSF residents where they just trained up their cohort in MAT and they had a just checklist protocol that was done at admission and at discharge by those resident teams. And their MAT prescription rates went from 0% up to 64% within 30 days. And they were also able to measure a reduction in 30-day readmissions, right? So we have running room here, and I would encourage you all to consider it. Summary, we had the MINT trial showing that that liberal transfusion strategy had a slightly lower rate of recurrent MI and death, mostly with type 1 events. We had the Cape Cod trial showing that steroids seemed to reduce 30-day mortality and did reduce need for intubation and severe community-acquired pneumonia. We had the Apprentice study. This was the cohort that I largely skipped, sorry about that, showing that LR seemed to be associated with lower rates of progression to severe disease and acute pancreatitis. We talked about phenobarbital as being a safe and alternative strategy to alcohol withdrawal treatments in the hospital with favorable pharmacology. And then we just talked about MAT for AUD. And I encourage you to take the opportunity. And with that, I'll hand things over to my colleague.
That's great, Ben. Thank you.
So as Ben and I were sort of preparing, the first step we did was just to look at all the notable articles that had come out in 2023. And as part of that review, we found three major trials that came out that I think are directly applicable to hospital medicine. And then, as many of you are, I'm sure, aware, the new guidelines came out this last year. So I'm going to actually focus the rest of the talk on hospital-related issues related to atrial fibrillation. I will tell you that unlike Ben's presentation there, this may not give you really easy things to know what to do with, but it will give you sort of a state of the state in terms of hospital medicine and AFib. And I think one of the difficult things about talking about AFib and hospital medicine is that you're really talking about a lot of different things and there's different studies. And I think one of the really important things to think about is who is my patient population? When you're comparing studies to make sure that you're using the right studies and the right patient population. So there's really five different places that we commonly encounter AFib in the hospital. there's a patient who comes in with AFib where that's the primary issue. And so usually they have RVR or heart failure that gets them in the door. There's the patient who comes in with stroke where we've identified AFib either at presentation or during the hospitalization on telemetry. There's a patient who comes in with stroke, but there's no identified AFib, the so-called embolic stroke of undetermined source. There's AFib that happens incidentally. So the patient comes in with a pneumonia or with sepsis or with a surgery and AFib pops its head up in that context. And then there's so-called subclinical AFib, which has become increasingly common, which is with our increased cardiac monitors. What do we do with AFib that we find on there? And these are all actually very different clinical situations. So I think it's important when we talk about the data to kind of separate those all out. First one I'd like to talk about is this one, the stroke admission without identified atrial fibrillation. We'll start with a case, and you know, in case you're not familiar with ESUS, ESUS is essentially, the patient who comes in with a stroke that it's not multifocal. We don't think it's embolic from a heart valve or from endocarditis. It's not a watershed stroke. This is our typical patient who comes in with a unilateral sort of one territory stroke. So this is a 67-year-old man admitted with right-sided weakness, expressive aphasia, 6 hours presentation. Typical protoplasm here, central hypertension, tobacco disease, tobacco use, diabetes type 2, hyperlipidemia. Standard screening labs on admission, negative EKG in sinus and admission, and an MRI with an acute left MCA territory stroke. So our typical management, we give them an aspirin, we bump the Lipitor up, they do brain perfusion imaging. He's determined not to be a candidate. On the CTA, he has non-surgical carotid disease bilaterally. We already spoke about the MRI echocardiogram. Notably has some moderate left atrial enlargement, but otherwise unremarkable. He gets 48 hours of telemetry without arrhythmia, manages blood pressure and his sugars, recommend tobacco cessation, and we plan to discharge into a SNF. So extremely common situation. So when you think about how do I prevent this patient's further risk of a stroke, do you start a DOAC despite no identified atrial fibrillation because of their high CHADS2-VASc score? You start a DOAC because of the high CHADS2-VASc score and left atrial enlargement, which is commonly something that we think about and look at. Do we order a hypercoagulable state panel because we don't have an etiology for the stroke? Do we discharge an aspirin and order a Zyopatch to evaluate for occult atrial fibrillation? Or do we order an echo medical study? So I'm going to present this article, which is the Stroke AF article. This came out this year, but this is actually the second report from this large trial. The first trial came out in 2021, and I'm going to start by just reviewing the initial report in 2021. And so this is essentially these patients, just as like I presented, the embolic stroke of unknown significance. And really, the question is, we don't have any idea, or we didn't have any idea, how frequent was it that we would find atrial fibrillation following that? So this is a randomized clinical trial, 33 US-based centers, and essentially they put in cardiac monitors in half of them, and then they did usual care in the other half, which is maybe I send you out on a Zyopatch, maybe your PCP does EKGs at follow-up appointments, we monitor for clinical symptoms, maybe do an EKG, so just standard care. And their population, interestingly, this also included lacunar infarcts, which is worth pausing on, but I'm not going to focus on. And these had to be older patients. These are sort of moderate CHADS2, moderate to severe CHADS2 VASc scores. They had a medium score of 5, and this is pre-pandemic here. So they enrolled about 500 patients. Very importantly, their goal was, their criteria for definition of AFib was greater than 2 minutes. And this is something that we're going to talk about in several different clinical situations. And especially when we're talking about that number, it's very important to think about which patient population we're looking at. And so they look for so-called AFTAS, atrial fibrillation discovered after stroke. And their goal in this study was really just to describe the rates of subsequent AFib, rather than to do a study where it looked at anticoagulation. And so this is the initial report in JAMA. And what they saw was that over the 1 year of that initial report, if you put in some sort of implantable cardiac device, you found much more atrial fibrillation versus control. So that top number there is the people who got a monitor. The bottom number is standard care. And also, if you look at that first month there, of the people who were ultimately determined to have atrial fibrillation, that Zio patch would have caught a very small percentage of those. Okay. So at one year, AFib defined as an episode of two minutes was detected in 12.1% with the monitor versus 1.8% of patients in the standard care group. Also importantly, the median time to identification was 3 months. So that monitor's not gonna catch most of that. And then there's some unclear clinical significance to what 2 minutes mean, although we'll return to this because I think in this patient population, 2 minutes means something, okay? The median time in people who had it determined was actually much longer than 2 minutes. It was, you know, in the hour and a half range. And then just for some prior background, people had looked at already in this context, well, if this is the case, why don't we put all of these people on oral anticoagulants? And so this is the RESPECT trial that came out. This was particularly in dabigatran, but this trial was essentially repeated in all of the DOACs. And what they'd shown, this is unselected ESOS patients. They randomized them to aspirin or rivaroxaban and looked at stroke and major bleeding. And all of the studies for all of the DOACs essentially showed no benefit of a DOAC over aspirin in an unstratified ESOS population. So this is their 3-year reports, and it's more of the same. I think the important parts to this are that it continued to increase. And so it depended on what duration, but at 1 year, if you used a 1 hour cutoff, you were up to 20% of the ESOS patients who had incident atrial fibrillation. So that top is the kind of blown up graph, by the way. The bottom number, if you look at the control there, you're detecting a very small percentage of patients. And then they actually broke it out into looking at what is the duration there, because there is a concept of atrial fibrillation burden, and it's one of the things that not necessarily in the ESUS population, and again, I want to call that out, but in other populations, that plays a big role. But you can see that your chance of catching 6 minutes of AFib was much better than your chance of catching greater than 1 day of AFib. And at a cutoff again of 1 hour, you had about 20% of patients at 3 years that had incident AFib determined. So in this patient population of 500, they had about 64% who did the 3-year follow-up. Cutoff at 1 hour was 20% versus 2% in the implantable cardiac or insertable cardiac monitors. And then when they looked at subgroups, they found that there's 4 factors that were associated with a significantly increased group of subsequent AFib detection. If you had a history of heart failure, if you had left atrial enlargement, as with our case, if you had a BMI greater than 30, or if you had a prolonged QRS greater than 120, your presentation or your chance of finding subsequent AFib was significantly increased. Incidentally, there was no stroke benefit determined with finding more of this, but this wasn't really part of the study. And there were many people who had AFib that didn't get anticoagulants, because presumably their providers made a judgment call that 6 minutes didn't meet their boundary. And there were many people who didn't have AFib who were started on oral anticoagulants. So it kind of torpedoed the benefit of oral anticoagulation in this study, but there wasn't any difference. So when I think about stroke AFib study, the take homes, one would be, we do a very bad job of identifying AFib following ESUS with usual care. Although we're not entirely clear what a short run of AFib means, but we're gonna talk more about that in a second. And the benefit of anticoagulation in very short runs of AFib is not fully established. In patients with ESUS, it appears to continue to rise up to about a max of 30% with a threshold of 6 minutes, and about 20% with a threshold of greater than 1 hour. And then, as I mentioned, your Zio patch is really only going to catch a very small part of those population. The other important things, I think, asymptomatic AFib was very common. So in the patient population who had the monitors, their subsequently identified AFib was asymptomatic in 88%. So a strategy of outpatient follow-up with EKG for symptoms is probably not effective. And then, as I mentioned, you have this higher subgroup population with those four categories. So if we go back to our case, the option of starting a DOAC just due to high CHA2DS2 fast score, we know the answer to that. And the answer is no. The option of hypercoagulable state panel or echo bubble study because of the pre-existing high CHA2DS2 fast score, the age, et cetera, that's generally not recommended. So I guess my answer would be to order a 30-day Zio patch, but recognize that I'm going to catch a very small percentage of the people incidentally. Also kind of left with this second one. If we find that, you know, there's a much higher incidence of subsequent AFib with patients with left atrial enlargement, maybe that's a population that will benefit. And this is what I'm talking about here. So can we use certain clinical characteristics to identify higher risk population for subsequent AFib in the ESUS population? And therefore, if we found those clinical characteristics, we would anticoagulate those patients. And so this is the Arcadia trial. This actually was formally published just a week ago, 2 weeks ago, but it came out in EPUB in 2023, so I considered it fair game. It's a randomized double-blind clinical trial, one of our best studies. This was Canadian and NIH US-based stroke centers, age greater than 45, CHA2DS2 vast score, moderate risk, 4.7. And they had to have ESUS with some evidence of an atrial cardiomyopathy. So they had to have an N-terminal BNP greater than 250, enlarged left to atrium or EKG findings. Don't ask me what that means, but some sort of EKG finding that it, identified higher risk. And they essentially randomized these patients to aspirin versus the DOAC. This is from actually the guidelines. And, you know, conceptually, when we think about AFib, we can think about you know, there is some sort of underlying protoplasm that makes people more more prone to AFib, and then there's some sort of trigger on top of that, be that infection, MI, surgery, sepsis, what have you. So the Arcadia trial, unfortunately, has come out, and there was zero benefit to anticoagulating this population, despite all really good data. And it was actually stopped early for futility. Notables in there, the intracerebral hemorrhage risk was actually lower for DOAC versus aspirin. So this, the ESUS population is going to get an aspirin no matter what. So in this situation, you can feel a little bit better about, you know, oh my goodness, am I going to create more intracranial hemorrhage? The answer is no. The bleeding risk was the same as aspirin. And then even kind of more damning, when they did a subgroup analysis to look at, okay, in the highest group CHA2DS2 vast score, did we benefit those people? The answer was no. So I think we can go back to our case and actually take B out based on the Arcadia trial. And it leaves us with the very unsatisfying 30-day Zio patch. Yeah. That's the status of where we are. Sorry, that's not terribly useful. So in the ESUS, AFib, extremely common after ESUS. We identify it much more commonly if we use some sort of implantable cardiac monitor. It's not entirely clear what duration of AFib confers a significant increased risk, and thus it's unclear if all patients with any AFib, we're moving away from all of our Coumadin studies, which were really in just clinical AFib now that we have all these monitors and things. Although I would, I'm gonna make some comments about that later. And then in a strategy of trying to identify patients who are high risk based solely on their clinical features, it doesn't work. And that's regardless of their CHA2DS2 vast score. So now I'm going to move on to, so we're putting ESUS away. We're going to move over to so-called subclinical AFib. And this is AFib without any symptoms that's found typically on a device interrogation. So keep in mind, again, we're moving to, you know, if you're a person who came in with a stroke, you automatically have a 2 on your CHA2DS2 vast score. This person may not at all, okay? So a 65-year-old woman with history of coronary disease and CABG and a previous VFib arrest with an AICD. She comes in with generalized fatigue and acute kidney injury. She has an EF of 40% documented, no valvular disease. She's on appropriate goal-directed medical therapy. Importantly, no history of cerebrovascular disease. We talked about her meds. She clinically looks volume depleted. She's on a diuretic. Her lungs are clear. She has no peripheral edema. Mission EKG is normal sinus. She gets a telemetry with no arrhythmia. She rules out. echo looks fine. So she gets rehydrated, her renal function normalizes, she's feeling better, she's ready to go. But you interrogated her pacer because you were worried about that. And you find that there's no shocks, but she now has documented 15 runs of AFib, lasting a maximum of 15 minutes since the last download. Okay, I've identified AFib. I'm going to start her on a DOAC. I'm going to order a TEE in her to identify, you know, try to find a thrombus and start a DOAC if I find that. I'm going to check a CT pulmonary angiogram. I'm going to add Plavix. I'm going to consult cardiology. So this is actually going to be increasingly common. And as we get better iPhones, this is going to be even more increasingly common. Okay. So this is data actually from cardiac devices. This was released in Circulation 2019. I think this is very applicable to our population. And what they saw in this is in cardiac devices, there was an interaction between duration of AFib and CHADS2 VASC score and risk of subsequent events. So if you had a CHADS2 VASC of 1, your risk was below that magic 1%, even with greater than a day of AFib. If your CHADS2 VASC score was 4, it mattered between whether you had less than a day or more than a day. And if you were greater than 5, it was more than a day. It was sort of applicable across. Now, I think it's important to point that out because the thing we just talked about is ESUS. And so those patients have a 2 already, okay? So that 6 minutes that we were just talking about in an ESUS patient is in the we need to anticoagulate kind of category, okay? So, and the reason I point that out is there's lots of data that shows that in identified AFib following ESUS, oftentimes people don't get anticoagulation. And that's actually a big gap issue in terms of our care. It also disproportionately affects minority populations, things that we should be working on, okay? So it's important, again, to remember which population. This is subclinical AFib, people who don't have a history of stroke. So this is the Artesia trial that came out specifically to look at this. And essentially, this is a double-blinded randomized trial. This is one of two that came out. 4,000 patients with some sort of cardiac device, a pacemaker, AICD, or just an intracardiac monitor. Older patients, mean CHADS2 VASC score of 4. And they put half of them into DOAC and half of them into AFib, into aspirin. And that was for a 6 minute to 1 day. And if you think about that, that makes total sense. They picked that 4 there. And so they're saying 6 minutes to 1 day, I'm going to anticoagulate those patients and see what happens. Okay. Their endpoints were stroke and bleeding. This again was EPUBbed last year, but came out formally this year. And what they saw was that this strategy actually worked in this population. Now, it's again, I'm going to say it again, but it's really important to think about your population. Who has device monitors? These are older patients in general with cardiac disease. So is this applicable necessarily to a younger patient without cardiac disease? Probably not. But they did see benefit, and it's pretty clear. Now, that top one is blown up a lot. That's 10% up at the top. The bottom one there, the absolute number is not all that crazy. So that when you break it all down, the stroke risk for AFib was 0.78 with DOAC versus 1.24%. Gives you a number needed to treat of 217 for stroke prevention. Bleeding risk, 1.71 versus 0.9. Number needed to harm for 129. Absolute numbers very low in this situation. They also did a meta-analysis in a differently published study of the NOAA study in the Artesia, and there was no change in all-cause mortality. So one might ask the question, how generalizable is this? Well, it's, you know, you're in square ground if this is a cardiac device. But does this mean anything for ESUS patients? Does it mean anything for any of the other patients? Not necessarily. This is a high-risk population that have a reason to have a device for some reason. The answer I'd say is consult cardiology in this situation. Okay, punt. They need to come and have a discussion about this. The numbers are real small again. So for, you have to treat 1,000 patients to prevent 4 strokes. You're going to buy 8 bleeds. I think importantly, the intracranial hemorrhage, and there's this constant debate about, well, do I really care about a major bleed if it doesn't kill them versus a stroke makes them hemipyretic? So I think importantly in here, intracranial hemorrhage was very similar to aspirin. And there's been several recent meta-analysis that came out that really suggest that DOACs are no worse than aspirin. If you're using a comparator of aspirin versus no therapy, you can feel better that you're not probably creating intracranial hemorrhage with that. Okay, so for the remainder of this, I'm going to focus on the things that we all see commonly, which is AFib, so-called precipitated AFib, or in the new guideline, they describe this as acute AFib. So this is AFib that you find while somebody's admitted for sepsis or pneumonia or what have you, certainly a very common thing that we see. So a 70-year-old gentleman who's admitted to the unit with sepsis related to cholecystitis. He needs pressors, he gets a biliary drain, antibiotics, et cetera, stabilizes. He's noted in the unit to have a run of AFib that lasts several hours, but with stabilization, he converts back to normal sinus, and then he gets transferred to the floor on my service for care. And I'm sitting there scratching my head, what do I do with this? AFib is AFib, put him on a DOAC. Let's put in an implantable cardiac monitor and sort this out. Let's check an echo, and if he has signs on the echo, let's start him on a DOAC. Let's check a TADS2 VASC score and anticoagulate if he's greater than 2 or traditional cutoff, or if he's very high risk. Or send out on a 30-day Zio patch. So this is actually data. So the rest of my talk is coming from the guidelines. This is some of the data that we have that helps us in this situation. This is from JAMA Cardiology back in 2016. And this is administrative data. So keep that in mind. But one of the interesting things from this, they looked at just all the patients who had a coexisting diagnosis of AFib and sepsis. And they looked at practice patterns across the United States. And so this is actually a plot of all of the hospitals or many of the hospitals across the United States. And what you see is nobody knows what to do. So there's a huge variation. Some people were anticoagulating everybody who got AFib in concept, and some people were anticoagulating none of them. There was, some small differences depending on which service you were on. And notably, the vast majority of these patients were on just the medicine service, which is, what I see. So the results of this, again, this administrative data was that there was, if you did not do propensity-based, matching or anything, unadjusted scores, there was no benefit. You see that confidence interval there for ischemic stroke clearly across one, and there was a clear signal for harm bleeding in that patient, the septic patient. And even if they did propensity score matching, those things remained. You still had a non-significant change in ischemic stroke and increased risk of bleeding. And their conclusion was that and they also did subgroup analysis, and the CHADS2 VASC score didn't even help you in this situation. So you couldn't even say, well, these patients who are high risk, they were the ones that were going to benefit. And again, you saw increased clinically significant bleeding during the hospitalization if you did that. So I think the answer is we don't really know, but probably anticoagulating those patients in the unit is a bad idea. When they get to the floor, I don't know. And the last one I want to talk about is infectious complicating sort of lesser degrees of stress. And this is also an older study, 2018. This is a retrospective study of administrative data. This was one hospital in Quebec. And they looked at lesser degrees of stress. So the acute pulmonary disease, which was just pneumonia, kind of a floor patient, COPD exacerbation and PE, jump to the chase, and essentially same findings here, okay? No clear benefit of anticoagulation. And this was actually out to 3 years post. So again, keeping in mind the limitations of this, our study demonstrates that the benefit of anticoagulation secondary AFib, what we now call acute AFib, is not strong and can be associated with a higher risk of bleeding. Careful assessment. So this is from the guidelines here. If you look at that right graph, it's just kind of bringing home that the less stressful event probably means that you're closer to that. They're going to more likely recur versus if you only see it in cardiac surgery, it may be less likely to recur. This is there somewhat helpful and somewhat not helpful. Acute precipitation there, anticoagulation after assessing risks and benefits. How do I do that? Counseling regarding risk of a recurrent AFib. Okay, you may have AFib. Arrange outpatient follow-up, AKA PUNT. And then in follow-up in the clinic there, assess need for continued rate of rhythm control and risk stratification for continued anticoagulation. So really no help, okay? So this is their guideline statement. Patients who are AFib in the setting of acute medical illness should be counseled about the significant risk, okay? Outpatient follow-up for oral anticoagulation initiation or continuation, so you could start it there or not, is recommended. And then probably in the case of sepsis with AFib, you are hurting the patient by anticoagulating in the case of acute sepsis. So transient AFib and acute medical illness, recurrence seems to be inversely related to the severity of the stressor. So no precipitant, that's kind of AFib. Cardiac surgery, not AFib. If sepsis studies suggest a lack of anticoagulation, what do I do with the patient who gets it with a low-grade pneumonia or a COPD? Is that more likely to recur as an outpatient? Thus, I should feel more, you know, more prone to anticoagulate them. Studies in ESAS at least suggest that Zyopatch is not going to help you. So what is the duration of AFib? And again, this is AFib not in the context of ESAS. That increases the risk enough to swing the balance in favor of anticoagulation. And so I think, you know, in these patients, we're left with a very unsatisfying CHADS2-VASc score, you know, burden of disease. The other thing that's in the current guidelines is that there are things, it's becoming clear that CHADS2-VASc score is not a perfect score. There are things that are in, that are consistently coming out as increased risk of subsequent stroke that are not in CHADS2-VASc score, and I wanted to call those out. So kidney disease, poorly controlled hypertension, obesity, proteinuria, all those things are actually should increase in your mind a little bit, the CHADS2-VASc score. The other thing to point out is that age is a much stronger risk factor. So even though you get one for age and you get one for diabetes, that one for age is a much higher risk factor. So if age is one of your points, that increases the odds. So my summary, stroke AF, AFib after ESUS is common, 30 days Zyopatch probably shouldn't make you feel any better. There's increased risk of certain subgroups, but the Arcadia trial says that's not super helpful. Arteza trial, this is in devices. There is a benefit to DOAC if you identify really any, but it's really small and associated with more bleeding, probably something to have the cardiologist talk to them. Transient AFib and sepsis, we don't know what to do, but probably don't anticoagulate them during the sepsis. And medical illness, even less clear. We're probably left with thinking about CHADS2-VASc and those other features, thinking about burden of AFib, how long it lasts. My references.
Wow, I don't know how you did it. You brought us perfectly to 9 o'clock. Thank you for just a wealth of information, practical and also super informative. I feel less alone in the wild world of hospital AFib. So thank you both.